All right. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today, both on webcast and in person. I apologize to anyone trying to join us from teleconference earlier. We had some trouble with that. So we are going to go over an update on the regulation, both the implementation, reporting, outreach, safety, and new verifications which affect the regulation, and then we're going to cover the legislative amendments. So we do appreciate everyone showing up here today. We did get a lot of feedback on those at the workshops, but we still have some questions we need answered to, and we're hoping you can help us out. Before we get into all that, I am going to welcome up someone from the Moyer program who's going to talk about a statewide funding option. So this is Jessica Dean. And she'll be going for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then we'll get into the off-road implementation update. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. My name is Jessica Dean. Thanks for being here today. As Corey said, I work in an incentives program here at ARB. You've probably seen me at OREAG meetings and trainings before. We're developing a loan guarantee program in coordination with the state treasurer's office. And this loan guarantee program is designed to help small businesses that may have trouble getting financing on their own from their own credit merits for their company. And we're working to be able to help them get financing for retrofits that they may need to come into compliance with the off-road rule. We've developed this draft of a pamphlet to tell fleets about this opportunity and to help them get more information and find out where they need to go to access that information. So I'm hoping that you can take a look at this and tell me what you think, give us some feedback. Mostly right now, I'm hoping you can help with the text to make sure that what the words say is the message that you think is going to be most effective for your colleagues and your customers. So if you would please take a look. Does anybody have any comments to start with? Just with that 30 seconds that you've had to look at it. Yes, sir. Oh, you have extras? Okay. So the basics of the program is it's accessible through the participating lenders. And that list is changing all the time. So we can't put that in the pamphlet because it'll be quickly out of date. But we do have a link in there to the participating institutions that's listed on the website, and that gets updated when we add a new bank.
Is this going to be low-interest loans?
Yeah, they are going to be lower interest than what the company might otherwise qualify for. But it's not low in terms of zero interest or 1% or 2% kind of thing.
Does this mean if you qualify for lending, then you don't get this assistance?
Yes. Yeah, it's designed for fleets that are something like nearly bankable.
Barely bankable is a term that I've read in some of the documents. Uh-huh. So that means what we're doing is we're supporting those that weren't prudent businessmen prior.
No, they can't
do it now. And the ones that have been prudent but are struggling through the economy because they're bankable, then you don't qualify.
Right, yeah. If you think these people might have been eligible for a loan maybe 6, 9, 12 months ago, but because of the way the credit market has tightened up, they're falling outside of those lending standards at this point. And or they may have just started a business in the past couple years, so maybe they don't have that long-standing credit history that banks like to see. Maybe they're just added some new equipment, and they've got a few more expenses than they have than they had before. So that those sort of things. If you think about the spectrum of the people on one end who have really great credit, they have lots of cash coming in, they have a very long business history. Think of those folks on one end. No bank is going to blink twice before they give them a loan. You think on the other end of the spectrum, you've got those with the worst credit. And right in the middle is that line where a bank would say yes, and the other side is where they would say no. And the point of our program is to move that line just a little bit so that it includes just a few more people than it would have before. We're not going for those high risk on that end of the spectrum.
How come the program is only for exhaust retrofits and not for equipment replacements?
Well, when Kim's group was starting to develop the rule, I think it was, is Mr. Porcher here? Yeah. I think you were the one that was telling Kim's staff that people were having trouble getting financing for retrofits because they didn't add production value, and sometimes there was already a lien on the existing equipment. So sometimes retrofits can be harder to finance just on their own. So that was the design in choosing just retrofits at this point. If we can prove that this program works and that it's successful and that this type of financing mechanism is helpful, we can make a strong case for expanding the program. And actually, that was one of our applications for the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funding that was offered by the federal government. We actually applied to expand this program to include off-road replacement and off-road equipment. So we'll see about that. We'll see how that goes. But if we can show that this program works, we can make a stronger case for asking for more money to do replacements.
How much money is available?
That depends on lots of things, where the money's coming from as far as...
Well, that would be the next question. Where
okay.
is it coming from?
It's coming from Assembly Bill 118. It's the first round of funding from Assembly Bill 118. And so at this point, we have about $30 million. And so that's going to be leveraged about 7-1 in terms of how many total dollars in loans we can finance. Any other questions? So this draft pamphlet is very, very draft. I'm hoping for your input as you guys are experts in off-road equipment and your ultimate customer that we're looking for is the people that are looking to install retrofits on their equipment. And we want to help them as best we can. So if we can make this program accessible to them and help them understand the program, that's what we're looking to do. So any help you can give us in that area, just based on what you read in the pamphlet, can you understand what the pamphlet says? Do you know what it means? Are your colleagues going to understand what it means when they take a look at it? And if that's true, do you know what you need to do to access that sort of program? So I'm looking for feedback. Does anybody have any at this point?
When you talk about those people who have been in business longer,
uh-huh.
that have established business and have a banking relationship, uh-huh. don't assume that they have a lot of cash coming in.
That's true.
It's not correct.
That's true.
Structure.
And
but
so
you did make the statement and just wanted to make sure you understand.
Yeah, definitely.
There are people that are still bankable, but it's a real struggle right now in order to maintain any business activity in
mm-hmm.
this state.
Yeah, and so those types of situations would be good cases for this program too. And so it's going to be a case-by-case basis. I can't stand up here and tell you that somebody with this credit score, who's been in business this long with this debt-to-income ratio, is going to qualify for the program, because it's all based on the lender's underwriting standards. So everybody's, if they're interested, if they think they're qualifying, if they're not able to get a loan or a loan on favorable terms, then this program is definitely something they should look into. Okay, well, I'll leave my card up here. Again, my name is Jessica Dean. My email address is jdean@arb.ca.gov. So if you have comments or questions based on this pamphlet, that'd be great. If you could email me and let me know so that we can turn this into a pamphlet that people can really use and understand and use it to get what they need and to utilize our program to get cleaner equipment. So thanks for your time.
All right, so we are going to move on to a update of the implementation of the off-road regulation. For those joining us by webcast, if you're interested in finding the presentation, you could go to our homepage, click on the ORIAG button on our local links to the left, and click on the meetings page, and it'll be available, either in handout form or the full presentation. So with that, we are going to cover today first implementation, legislative updates, and then we're going to get an update on the subcommittees that we held earlier this morning. And we'll have the subcommittee chairs present those and discuss what conclusions we came to. So for reporting, I know a lot of you deal with the regulation as much as we do, but for everybody else, we are in the middle of our reporting cycle. We have passed the deadline for large fleets. It was on April 1st, but over a month ago. We still have large fleets coming in and reporting, though. We do have two upcoming deadlines for medium fleets and small fleets about 3 months out. So reporting data so far, at the beginning of the month, we had about 81,000 vehicles and 1,350 fleets that had reported. Additionally, we had fleets that were in the process of reporting who'd put in about 12,000 vehicles and 1,400 fleets. So we do expect not all, but some of those to be added to our list. And this is increasing every day. Although we passed the deadline for large fleet reporting, we still have large fleets coming in, and we're not putting a hold on those as of yet. So to get a look at how this played out, you can see in January we had around 10,000 vehicles, and then we slowly started increasing. Just to give some reference for this graph, the reporting tool was actually up since September of last year. So we went about 6 months till March, and we're a little bit over 20,000 at that point. And then as the deadline approaches, of course, we basically tripled the amount of vehicles that were in there. So as we come up on the medium and the small fleet deadlines, it's going to be pretty hard to tell before we hit those dates how many are going to be reported. So I know a lot of ORIAG members had requested additional information. We are looking at the type of information from the report. But until we hit those medium and small fleets, any information we give you would be updated continually. And as this graph shows, people wait till the last minute. So as we hit those dates, one of the things we're going to do in the board update later this year is give an update on the reported information. So at that time, we'll be in a better place to give all the types of information that was requested. But we do want your input on what summaries, what analysis of the data would be useful to industry. So just to give you an...
We gave you a request, specific request,
yes.
Specific kinds of information,
so
which would be useful. And from your answer, I'm hearing that you're not going to provide that.
We're not providing it, or we're not doing the analysis until we get more information. We do plan on giving an update to the board with the reported information once we hit medium in June. Once we hit medium and small fleet reporting dates.
That'll be September.
But right. Whoa. Corey's not responding to the Public Records Act request from AGC or CIAC's lawyer. Corey's talking about what he's sharing in his presentation.
I made a specific non-Public Records Act request for data and non-responsive.
Right. If we gave you, you asked for an analysis of the reported information versus the model. So what we have right now is we're past the large fleet reporting deadline, but we don't have medium or small fleets, and we're still getting large fleets. If we gave you an analysis or a comparison versus the earlier data, we'd have to update that as soon as more information came out. As we're going to give the board...
There were two requests. One was for data based on what we assumed to be the large fleet deadline, and the second was for a comparison, but it were two separate requests. It wasn't a unified request.
Right. So we do have your request for information, and we will be looking at that. At this time, we're not releasing more information than our total vehicles. We're not going to spend the staff time doing an analysis that we'd have to update almost instantly. It'd almost instantly be obsolete. If you look again at the chart, before you hit the reporting deadlines, you don't have a good prediction of what's going to be reported. Everybody waits till the last minute. So we are going to come out with more information on the data that's been reported, and we will keep in mind your request, Bill, but at this time, we're giving you a basic information about how many have been reported, but we don't have more.
Corey.
Who are the other 14,000 fleets, or 1,400 fleets? I mean,
some of these are small fleets, some of those are medium fleets, other fleets that are large fleets that are in the process of putting in their data. Some of those are actual test cases by consultants who aren't going to report the information. They're just putting it in there. So it's a mix of all of that.
Okay, so it's sort of not real information then? Is that what you think?
It's information that's in the process of being reported and a mix of not real information. I'd say there's probably not that many not real vehicles in there because most consultants don't put in fleets of 1,000 vehicles. But yes, it's a mix of all of that.
I think Granite's consultants do that, but that'd be it.
That might be it.
Looking at this 80 to 90,000 vehicles that might represent most of the sample for large fleets, how does this number compare with the projections that were made prior to the finalization of the rule or in the final staff report?
I don't have the exact figure with me. I believe the estimate for vehicles in large fleets only was on the order of 130 to 140,000. So that would be, I can look that up for you. That'd be my offhand estimation. So this puts us roughly in the, depending on how many of these vehicles make it in the permanent files, it puts us roughly at the 70% range or somewhere in that regard. More do come in every day, so it's hard to do an analysis of a comparison of that. So obviously by September we'll be pulling together and presenting not a final analysis, because we do expect fleets to continually report as time goes on. You never get quite 100%. You always aim for it, but we're always going to have more fleets coming in. So in September, we are looking to have better information than we do now.
Do you have a guess as to whether the initial projections expected too many vehicles to be in the fleet based on what we know now?
So that's one of the reasons why we're not going to spend a lot of time running analysis now, because it could be that our large fleets are smaller than we thought, or there's fewer vehicles in them, and that medium is much higher or lower as well. So as soon as we pass the medium and small, we'll have a much better idea. We still have to look at things like industry saturation. How many of the large fleets have actually reported? So it's difficult to do an estimation like that. What we can compare is what's been reported. But we're going to have to look at factors such as, out of all the large fleets in California, how many do we think are in there? So there's certain ways that we can look at that. I don't know how good of information we'll have to compare it to the original estimation of vehicles.
If the emissions that result are overstated in the estimates, then everything is fine. What happens if the emissions, though, are such that we get in trouble as far as the SIP is concerned?
So I don't have a firm answer for you on that. That will be up to our board when we hold the board meeting, if we have a substantially different fleet than we thought. There's a number of factors we're not going to have by September. We don't require activity as part of initial reporting. So, you know, whether we have 100,000 vehicles working 2,000 hours a year, or 200,000 working 1,000 hours per year, you know, that's part of what we'd look at when it goes into emissions. So even by that date, I'm not sure we'll have good enough information on activity to run a comparison. We could make estimations of it, but then we're not comparing what's real versus our previous estimation. We're just comparing more assumptions versus that. So I don't know if we'll have an update on the emissions by the board date. As far as what would happen if that came to pass, that would be entirely up to the board.
Corey, you said that you're still accepting reports from large fleets. Are there any penalties for late reporting?
There are penalties set up. Our section isn't enforcing them because, for one, we're in implementation.
You're better off getting the data
than
not. Yeah.
We figure we're better off getting the data. There is going to be a date at which our enforcement section goes out into the field, looks for reported information, and will be issuing fines.
Do you know what the date is?
I don't have a firm date on that.
You have a rough guess date.
No, he doesn't.
Does anybody know when?
We're still discussing that internally, so no.
When I looked at the data on the compliance certificates that were issued, there were 1,290, and our members made up about 80 of that, and almost all of our large fleets were in there. Some I contacted some of them. They said they'd reported, but they weren't. Their names weren't in the system yet. And so we were discussing that earlier today. So I'm going to have to go back to those people and say, hey, you know, you either didn't hit the submit button or something.
Right.
But, you know, I kind of need to give them, you really need to get this done by June 1st or you're going
right. So to tag on what Kim said, if you want an official date, it's April 1st of this year. That's the legal date. That's when they have to have it in. Anything beyond that is purely a, is grace for them. It's not
an informal grace period.
Right.
So I mean, they could be fined per day that they're late. So.
Yes, I know that. That's certainly why I want to have some push down factor. I mean, we really are communicating with all 300 of our members about this, and our response has been good based on what I saw on the reporting data. At the same time, we went through the incredibly bad experience with the portable rule, and I don't want to see that repeated on this rule. And so if we can, you know, just get pushing it. We're doing as much pushing, maybe more, than you guys are within our own sphere.
We don't. We're not going to have a formal grace period where we say, "Oh, well, it was April 1st, but we meant September." We're not going to do that. We are talking internally about when we actually go out and aggressively enforce it, and that. Honestly, we're not just being secretive. The decision hasn't been made about when we go out and do that. But you can tell them that every day they're late, they're increasing their potential fine. So, and it could be something
it's not going to be ex post facto, though, right? I mean, you will set a date, and then after that date, then it will become.
The date was April 1st.
So it is ex post facto.
Yeah, I mean, that date was April 1st. But so it could be something totally innocent where they didn't understand that they were supposed to submit for review or something. So
well, yeah,
I would strongly encourage them to call the Doors hotline or call one of my folks individually, and we'll work it out with them.
And to clarify on the grace period, if enforcement does go out there right now, they do have the authority to enforce fines. And this is notwithstanding the waiver that we're applying to for the U.S. EPA. The reporting requirements are separate from that because
they're not emissions requirements. You can't enforce the emission benefits until you get the waiver, but that you can enforce the paperwork requirements. Everyone's aware of that. It's just like the portable. We used to have a waiver on that either.
So they are past the deadline if they're a large fleet and they haven't reported, and they can be fined. So hopefully that's enough motivation for them. If you have any other ideas, we'd be glad to hear it.
What are the fines?
The fines are up to $10,000 per vehicle per day.
What are the fines? Yeah, I've had people ask me when they say up to, then they say, well, what's realistic?
He's not kidding.
I've had people ask when you say up to, then they says, what does that really mean? Is it $10,000 a day, or is it $40 a day? Is it 1 cent a day? The wide range doesn't mean anything. People laugh.
Right.
So that's why we'd like to have...
Ask them to call MCM Construction and see how they're laughing. They got fined $10,000 per day per machine under the portable regulation. It was a $34 million fine. They were sued by the Attorney General of the State of California. There was a settlement in the case. And it wasn't $34 million, but it was $6 million. Plus, they had to do additional compliance activities that are going to cost them about that much again. It's not a joke. These guys really are serious. And since they get paid a portion of the funds that their agency operates on from these fines, you know they're going to be serious about it now that the state's in financial trouble.
I understand that, but what is... up to, why don't they just set a number? Why is it up to?
We could ask enforcement if they'd be willing to discuss.
No, they wouldn't. They wouldn't set a number, and here's why. Okay, so if we tell you, okay, it's up to 10,000, it's really $50 a day, then people are going to make the calculation. Well, okay, how much is it going to cost me to comply versus how much is it going to cost if I get caught? And if the latter number is less, they won't comply. So we want people knowing that they could be subject to big fines, and so we want them to comply. So we're not going to tell.
Then
even
why don't
if we
you
have...
just say it's $10,000 a day?
We do.
No, you say up to.
But it
well, it's
up
not
to.
A flat fine of $10,000. It's up to enforcement personnel's discretion. So maybe we need to be a little clearer on the outreach that the $10,000 per day fines are applicable. As Bill was talking about with MCM, it's not always a much smaller number. There may be a settlement, but there might not be as well.
And there were others that got fined under the portable regulation, which still doesn't have a waiver, but the requirements were registration requirements. These companies didn't comply, and they were tagged for millions of dollars in fines.
I think it's a point well taken, though, that saying up to $10,000 may not be a very specific information that motivates fleets, though. All right, so did anybody have any questions before we move on? Talk a little bit more about reporting. We did make hard copy forms available, and if anybody wants a copy of those, we can mail them to you. The vast majority, of course, are using the online reporting tool. It has a large number of advantages, but there are some small fleets. We've had roughly 90 requests, and we've had, I believe, about a dozen or so fleets return forms. So reporting has begun by hard copy forms as well. So once fleets are reviewed, I know most of your fleets in here, but for those who aren't, once fleets report to us, they do go through a review process. We check through their data, see how complete it is, and see if it seems like they understood the rules or understood the fields that we were asking for. The main offender, of course, is engine family. A lot of people don't know what that is. They think it's the engine model or other things. So when we run across a situation or somebody has a bunch of new vehicles but no serial numbers, we get back to them. We ask them, you know, why are you missing all this information? Are you sure you understand the requirements? So that's part of the reporting process, and it's still ongoing. And it will, of course, ramp up as we get the small and medium fleets reporting. So as many of you have already seen, we have the Certificate of Reported Compliance up. It is available online. And we're going to look at different ways to make it easier to use with possibly just instructions or other tools.
Will that be sent out to each company yearly as they continue to comply?
So we are going to send out a package for initial reporting. And the package will include equipment identification numbers. And I think we've run that past ORIAG a few different times to see what they thought of the package. So I believe we may include the certificate with that initial one. I don't think we have plans to do a yearly one. We do plan to have the yearly one available online, though. So it won't be mailed to them each year. If everyone on ORIAG thought that was a good idea, we could definitely consider it. But hopefully, once the certificate of reported compliance is very easy to use with the browsers, then it won't be too much of an issue. So again, we're reviewing the reporting data, and we do have some suggestions for what ORIAG would like to see. If anybody else has any thoughts about what analysis or comparisons would be useful to industry, we'd also be interested in hearing those. So let's talk about outreach and how to get those fleets that have not reported into our system. A lot of you did see our statewide training seminars. So this map shows generally where they are. We tried to go pretty much all over the state where fleets were represented and would come to listen to the seminars. And we also do smaller presentations to interest groups, and we are doing a lot of mail-outs currently, trying to hit all the industries that we may have missed. We have pretty we've been focusing a lot on the construction industry, the building industry, but there's other industries that we're trying to reach that may not have been included on this. So that's one of the things we're focusing on now in outreach, and we could definitely use suggestions. So for the training seminars, we had about 2,100 people over the 22 seminars across the state. They started last year. In the future, we're looking at how to best run these classes. A lot of you have been to them, and I'm sure you can tell when there's 250 people in an audience, it can be very difficult, especially for people who are just hearing about the regulation, to learn anything, just because the questions and the size of the audience doesn't allow you to get very personal with them, to discuss their fleet, to make the regulation make sense to them. So we're looking at how large of the classes to do, how frequent to do them, and where to do them. We're considering possibly just having one in the Los Angeles area and one in Sacramento that we hold once a month in each location or something like that. So if you have any thoughts about that, or if you know areas that could use a lot, that would have a lot of fleets who would come out and these training seminars would be useful for them, we'd definitely be interested in hearing that. We haven't set up our future, our plans, but we are definitely interested in doing more training seminars. Most of them went very well, and they were pretty informative to fleets, apparently. So if ORIAG or any of you have any ideas about how to manage that better, a lot of you went to a lot of our meetings, so we definitely appreciate feedback. So these are some of the interest groups we've talked to. And we've tried to cover as wide a range as possible. Pretty much anyone that's interested or that we think has equipment, we'll reach out to, try and set up something for either their members, if they're an association, or if they're just a widespread industry, try and contact as many of them as possible. We get a lot of invitations to seminars or other things like that. So again, if you have more ideas on industry groups we can hit. Does anybody have any thoughts immediately? If not, you can email me or Beth White. Any contacts we get, we try and follow up on. We've done a lot of smaller presentations in addition to our statewide seminars. So currently for mailings, we are going to be working with the Contractor State License Board. So every licensed contractor in the state is going to get a flyer. And I have a few examples up here. But it's a one-page flyer in both English and Spanish that covers the basics of the regulation, points them to our website for more information. So hopefully that'll be a great way to reach a lot of the smaller contractors who may not have any association affiliation or things like that, but they are a licensed contractor. And again, if you have any ideas for how we can reach all the other small contractors or other small businesses that may not have heard about this, or large businesses for that matter, we'd appreciate ideas. Right now we're working on one to specialized groups such as golf courses, cemeteries. We're doing one to retail industries which may have things like forklifts. So if you have ideas for who we can reach out, or you know somebody that hasn't reported and others in their industry might not have, we definitely appreciate that information.
Are the forklifts and the warehousing industry included in this rule?
If they're off-road diesel forklifts, yes. There are a few examples of forklifts that aren't, such as the cargo handling ones at ports and things like that.
Right. Well, there's just thousands and thousands of warehouses. I don't know of an association, but I do know that there's a huge, huge industry. Did you guys get around the state printing office yet? Or?
Yes, we have dropped off the initial flyers to the Contractor State License Board. I did that in person, and I'm dropping off another 45,000 in the next couple of days.
Great.
To go out with their next
Great.
Few
that
months.
That was unfortunate that it didn't get the information out before the deadline started hitting. So
hopefully we can reach most of the small contractors on time. But, yeah, we would have liked to have done that sooner. We also do things like posters and flyers, which you've seen, and we did some radio spots. So if you have – go ahead.
I'm sorry. Where are the radio spots running? Because their radio stations right now have tons of time available for public service.
So we did send out – we set up a public service announcement, and then we sent out – I think primarily it was the country music stations. I don't know exactly which ones here, but I believe we do have a list of that.
Have you checked on the actual broadcast of them? Because I haven't heard them anywhere.
I believe we have heard reports that people have heard them.
Okay, great.
But they don't give us any statistics. They won't tell you, oh, we played it this many times on such and such day.
No, but they should indicate to you at least that they've received it and that they're going to use it. You know,
well,
I worked
they,
in the industry for a
yeah,
long time.
Yeah, but we had one of our students do this as a project.
Right,
and what we learned was they'll accept it, but they won't guarantee that they'll play it because they're sort of choosing among all the ones that they accept. So we have heard back that some people heard it, so we know at least some of them were played, but we don't know how often. Right. And we do have the posters. If anybody wants a poster for their place of business, have these little – this is what they look like. So I don't know if Michael's still here. Oh, yeah. So if you want one of these – if you want one of these for yourself or to give to a friend, then talk to Michael.
So again, if we didn't hold an outreach subcommittee this time, based on time, but if anybody has ideas, even crazy ones, for how we can reach more fleets, we want to hear it, because maybe there's a way to do it. So along with our outreach, we've been developing the information for fleets, and we're trying to make this easier to access and make it a little bit easier to for fleets to find and find the information they're looking for. So a lot of you have helped us develop these guides and other FAQs. But one of the questions we have is we get a lot of calls, but we know there's a lot of people on the OREI committee who also work with fleets. So if you're hearing the same questions over and over, then we would appreciate that information because we can set up something like a frequently asked question or a guide for it and then make it easier for fleets. And anybody who asks you, you could then just forward them the guide as well. So if you have thoughts on that, you can, again, just email me. It doesn't have to be the most important issues, just common questions. A lot of the things which we deal with in the regulation that we get used to, a lot of fleets still have questions about that. So we definitely appreciate your input on that. So before we go on to safety, did we have any mailed-in questions? No? Okay. So we did talk about this a little bit in the subcommittees. We have proposed some amendments to Title VIII, and we are working with Cal OSHA staff who are developing this proposal to go to their board. So we have sent in our proposal, which I'll cover in a little bit of detail here. Our goals were basically to set up consistent standards, which were also objective. And one of the reasons for this is if we set up objective, measurable standards, we can have fleets determining safety, and we can have installers determining safety without having to have a Cal OSHA inspector out there each time. So we did want something that an engineer could go out and look at and perform. Basically, we went with a proposal of the ISO 5006 standards, and they set up specific criteria. The basic way they work is they look at the field of view of an operator in all directions, and then they have standards for how much a device that was added could interrupt the field of view. So we are doing some initial analysis of how this would work, and we are working with their staff. But until they come up with their proposal and they go to their board, we're not going to have more information, which is one of the reasons why we didn't have a safety subcommittee this time. We are waiting to work with them and get back with them, and then they're going to go to their board, and then probably a regulation or an amendment to the regulations would be put in place, although they could perform more investigation at that time. So as we have more information on that, we'll share it with you. So before we went on to that, did anybody have questions about the safety amendments that ARB has proposed? I know we talked about it previously at one of the teleconferences.
Well, as I remember the discussion that we had, there was a lot of hocus-pocus about ISO 56 or 5006 because it's a privately branded product that you had to pay for, if I remember correct, Elizabeth, and you couldn't share with anyone. And so,
yeah, it's pretty similar to any standard that you want to buy.
None
like
of us
that.
Understand what it says. And has your guidance to Cal OSHA, is that something that we can see and understand?
Which guidance are you talking
the,
about?
The stuff that's based on the ISO 5006.
I don't understand what stuff that you're talking about. I'm sorry.
What'd you send OSHA?
We sent, well, you...
I saw
you
the letter, but that
well,
is certainly not
that's
a standard.
That's the last thing that we sent to OSHA.
That's it. That's all.
Yeah, other than agreeing to meet with them, basically, okay. Soon, hopefully.
Yeah, I was gonna. That was going to be my next question, is what is your timing look like?
We're not exactly sure. They've asked us to gather some information. And once we get the information together, we'll be able to sit down and meet with them. I haven't even yet proposed dates. I'm supposed to propose several dates for them to choose from, and I haven't actually even sent that off to them yet. So,
are we thinking this year?
Oh, well, I would certainly hope so.
Well, are we thinking this quarter?
To meet with them?
Mm-hmm.
I would. You mean like within the next 3 months? Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely. I would certainly hope so.
I'm only asking because, you know, in the morning conversation, we related the call that I got from another association, said they had an OSHA consultation. They said they'd get cited if they installed a VDEC on a certain piece of equipment.
Right.
And, you know, this is going on out there, and...
No, I understand,
you know,
but, you know, it's two agencies trying to work
this whole
together.
Process.
I know. It's two agencies trying to work together. There's other stakeholders, too. Obviously, there's the original petition. So they have to deal with everybody and try and come up with a proposal that they feel meets all of the criteria that needs to meet. So, I mean, it's a process. So the next step is for us to meet with them and answer the questions that they've asked of us and go from there with the proposal that they're going to make. So, yeah, we're trying to push it along as quickly as we can. We realize that industry needs answers on this, so...
Well, all of us. I mean, I'm sure you guys would like to get this out of the
well,
way,
yeah,
too, so that
right.
So that this isn't the elephant in the living room.
I think we definitely realize that as soon as possible is best, but they are going through their regulatory process, so they will have a 45-day process for discussion.
That only starts after they've promulgated the rule, and they can't promulgate the rule until you guys have your meetings, and so I'm just trying to get
right.
a feeling.
Right, and that's why I wanted to make sure he bulleted, you know, sort of this, then this, then this, then this, you know. And so, yeah, that's what we're looking at. We answer their questions. We sit down with them and talk to them about it. They come up with their proposal after they've talked to us and whoever else they need to talk to. Then there's a 45-day public comment period. Then they have their board hearing.
Since this is going to interfere with the installation of decks, well, then this delay in this decision then add to the amount of time allowed to get the decks in place.
I mean, like, would we put anything into the reg to delay requirements?
Well, if we can't put the decks on because we're going to interfere with something that OSHA thinks would be a violation.
Oh, well, there's safety provisions in the reg already. If it can't be safely installed, then you don't have to put it on. So that already exists. And you would obviously have to go with whatever the regulations are today. And if they haven't been amended yet and you're putting it on today, then you go with today. And if 6 months from now they're amended and there's different criteria, then that's what you would have to go by then at that time.
So if you've got to do 20% of your horsepower this year by January 1, and so you pick the ones that are applicable and then they come up against a file with OSHA, does that mean you have to go and then find another one of your pieces of equipment and try to make that one work?
all that, I would think so. Kim?
Well, the deadline isn't until March 1st, and our intent is to try to work this out. So, folks, I think the point you're making, Skip, is that you guys need clarity on what's safe and what's not as quickly as possible. And when we share the desire for that, and we'll work it out absolutely as quickly as we can.
I just want to know if it takes 6 months to get it worked out, because if you talk about meeting this quarter and then 40 and then a promulgated rule and then a 45-day public comment, we're maybe talking 180 days before we actually have a rule in place that gives us clear guidance as to what we can and cannot do. And so 180 days from now, like, it puts us at the end of the year. And we heard earlier in conference that if you order up your stuff on December 15th, you're not going to have it. You're not going to get it, because all the orders will be coming in once the rules are promulgated. So what I'm asking is, if you have a March 1st deadline for meeting this regulation, but you don't get a real good clearance until December 1st, so we sit around for 180 days, does that add on to the time allowance in order to meet the regulation?
Yeah, I don't think we're going to change any of the time allowances for that. We just try and get as expeditiously as we can get the reg amendments made with OSHA's help, our OSHSB, and get those through as quickly as we can. And certainly as you're looking at your fleet and you want to look at what 20% you should retrofit, you would be weighing every, you know, cost and safety and all of those things to try and assess which pieces of equipment you want to retrofit. That's the best advice I think I have for you right now.
Thank you.
Thanks, Skip.
Hey, Corey.
Yes.
State Porcher, Camarillo Engineering. In the teleconference, the ISO 5006, I went ahead and took my doggy treat money and bought it. And on page 16, we had talked at one time about manufacturers being involved in safety of installations. And on page 16 of the ISO document, it says, for machines that are not included in Table 1 due to their machine mass, large size, the manufacturer should apply the tests and criteria specified in the international standard. For those machines that do not meet the criteria for the highest specified category of machine mass in the respective machine family, manufacturer shall consider appropriate technical measures. Anyway, I was just wondering if ARB had considered including manufacturers in the verification process for installations.
We have heard
for the safety end of it.
If you're talking about the original equipment manufacturer for that machine, then we have heard the idea before, but of course that would rely on them approving the installation of the device, which they will have no motivation to do. And in some cases, they'll have a conflict of interest because it'll be their machine. If it's somebody else's product, obviously the manufacturer is not going to approve anybody else's device if they have one of their own they're trying to sell.
Well, I understand your thought process there, but if we're going to go off the ISO standard, it does refer to going to the equipment manufacturer for guidance.
David, this is why we love you.
We
you actually spent the money to go see this stupid thing. And if we're going to follow it, we ought to be following it all the way, not pick and choose from column A and column B that suits the agency's particular requirements.
I don't think we're looking at picking and choosing any part of the ISO standards. Dave, for that detail, I think let's talk about that later, just because of time today. And then possibly we can look at including that on when we talk with OHSHB.
Okay, I'd just like it to stay up on the surface.
No, that's fine, Dave. And you know, I talk to you offline a lot, so I'm happy to talk to you about that and work that. I'm working fast and furiously on information for OSHSB,
okay,
so I'm
I
happy to talk
to you
about
that.
Okay,
I just wanted to get it out there.
Yeah, no problem.
Thank you. No, thank you, Dave. So we are going to go on to the devices that have been either conditionally verified or had their verifications expanded. The CAT verification, the horsepower was lifted. The restriction to rubber tire was also lifted, so we got a wider verification. We also got the first NOx device conditionally verified the Lone Star, which has 40% NOx. And just because there was some confusion about this during the workshop, for 40% NOx, it works the same as basically two-thirds of a repower. We divide the number that it reduces NOx by 60%, and then we apply that to the vehicle. So if a 300-horsepower vehicle had this device installed, they get 200-horsepower credit towards NOx and 300 towards PM. So there's not a limit that it has to reduce NOx by before you start getting credit. We also had an active and a passive system join our other three previously verified active systems and the passive system previously in place. So we are getting a wider verification and a wider net of the off-road diesel fleet. It is happening slower than we'd like, so we are aware of that. And again, when we update the board, we will be discussing both the fleet and the decks that have been verified. So we are going to get into the legislative directive changes now. If anybody hasn't actually seen them at all before, we do have on the back of your handouts the actual language provided by the legislature to amend the off-road diesel regulation.
Hey, Corey, this is Ev Ashworth. I had a quick question.
Sure.
When we have a 40% NOx retrofit, why wouldn't it apply to the complete 300 horsepower and that's the best available today?
So the way we look at it is if that retrofit reduces NOx by 60%, then they get that full 300. If it reduces it by a portion of that, then they get a portion of the credit. So that's why we look at it that way. The other option would have been to limit NOx credit to devices which only reduce it by a certain amount. So does that make sense? So if it reduces NOx by 30%, then they get half credit, or 150 horsepower. So does that answer your question, Eb?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay. So to give a little background on the... Naturally. So looking at the legislatively directed changes, a lot of you went to our workshops, but for those who didn't, as part of the recent budget deal, the legislature directed ARB to change the regulation in three ways. The first was to the 2011 to 2013 back requirements, and additionally to provide credit for retirements and reduced activity. So we're going to cover each of these in a little bit of detail, and I'll cover the changes that we've put in since the workshops. So the purpose of these, each one in different ways, give credit for fleets that have been impacted by the decline in the economy or reduce in their own business. Or it also makes it easier for people who haven't had that by changing the back requirements in 2011 through 2013 in some ways. So we had two workshops on that. I know a lot of you were at both. And we did get a lot of feedback, and we have made some changes to our proposal that will go before the board. But we still have some questions to answer. So we are going to have a staff report on these changes. It's scheduled for June. And then in July, we have a board hearing. So these will actually go into place, or some variation of them. So this one's pretty simple. It was the first. It was the change to BACT. It made the 2011 and 2012 requirements easier for those fleets who aren't meeting the fleet averages. And then it added what they no longer have to do onto their 2013 date. So by 2013, they're still going to have to do the same amount of actions. It just relaxes what they have to do in 2011 and 2012. To give you the actual percents, previously they had to turn over 8% of their horsepower, retrofit 20%, and that's going to change to 4.8% turnover and 12% retrofits by total horsepower. And then in 2013, all the things they didn't have to do in 2011 and 2012 get added on, and they have an increased requirement. So this one's pretty simple. The language on it's pretty direct. We haven't had too many questions or suggestions for implementing it differently. If you have thoughts on it, though, we'd love to hear them. But the language in the language sent to us by the legislature is pretty clear on this one, and it's pretty simple. The one change that we're going to make to this, or we're proposing to make to this, that's not in the language, is that for fleets which meet the fleet averages in 2011 and 2012, we're not going to hold them responsible for the higher 2013 requirements, just because that would make the reg stricter for them, and they're a pretty clean fleet. They're meeting it in 2011, 2012. We don't want to go along and then in 2013 hit them with this large bump that would be applied to the fleets who'd done less in the previous 2 years. So
then that also applies to medium fleets who don't really even have a requirement until 2013?
So medium fleets wouldn't be affected by this at all. Their first aid in 2013 would be 8% turnover and 20% retrofits. We wouldn't apply the increase in 2013 to them.
Hey, Corey, just to confirm, if the carryover credit would work the same as previous, right? So if you exceeded, like, the 4.8, it would still carry over to the next year?
We haven't looked at the actual language on that. So right now it still says 8%. That's one of the things we can consider. But I don't know that we've actually set up the language on that.
Well, I want to make sure, like, so just theoretically, if we were to turn over 6% and 6%, then, you know, that exceeds what the 4.8% was. So 6%, 6%, 14.4% is going to be
way over compliance.
Way over right. What we would have previously had to do.
So I believe our intention is to not increase it at all. So I think we're in agreement on that one. Okay. We can talk about it. But, yeah, I believe we're in agreement.
Corey?
Yeah, and just to clarify there, yeah, it would work the same way. So if you do a little beyond what's required, you get to carry that over to the next year. We're still, I think what Corey's saying is we're still drafting all the reg language, but it's definitely going to work the same way as before.
We had another question.
Yeah, Corey, Tom Swenson, Clear. You had said for fleets that are meeting the original schedule, you don't want to penalize them, which makes sense. Do they have to declare up front which path they're on, say, a la the transit rule?
No.
No.
So if we hit 2012 and they've been meeting the fleet averages, then their requirements for 2013 will be the lesser requirements.
And do they make that determination? Do they make a request to you to say, I'm exempt from, I mean, I'm just looking for the mechanics of...
So indoors will automatically be able to tell whether their fleet, as reported for 2012 and 2011, met the fleet averages or not. So we'll know by what they've reported which path they've been on. So, and if they've met both, then obviously they've also met the fleet averages, so they will be... not be held to the high requirements in 2013 based on our proposal. All right, so that's the first one, relaxed in 2011, 2012, increases in 2013. So the second one is a credit for reducing horsepower. And in the legislature language, it says March 1st, 2006 to March 1, 2010. So it is a large window. And at the workshops, as many of you may recall, we had first... initially proposed limiting it to the fleet's older horsepower just so that somebody didn't have tier zeros, they were getting rid of their tier threes, and then they were getting credit for that. But based on comments and just looking at it, we didn't feel it was close enough to the intent of the legislature, and there's certain reasons why a fleet could have inadvertently, you know, made things worse for themselves. For instance, they might have been holding off on their tier zeros to retire to get credit later. So under our current proposal, we are proposing any reduction in total horsepower from March 1st, 2006 to March 1, 2010 would simply be directly counted as both PM and NOx credit. So did anybody have any questions on that one? And this credit doesn't expire, so it goes towards BACT during the first years that the fleets need it. Any questions? No? Okay.
Wait. Sorry.
We do have one.
Just one. March 1st, 2006. Okay. Now, is that going to go from March 1st right to 2010, the total reduction? Or are you going to require 1 year to 1 year to 1 year?
We'll be looking at the total reduction under the current proposal. So whatever their total fleet was on March 1st, 2006, and then whatever their total horsepower was on March 1, 2010, not year by year. So if you decreased in 1 year, went back up, decreased another year, went back up, you wouldn't get credit for it if you ended at the same place you started, just for decreasing in some of the interim years and then increasing in other years.
Okay. I got it. Thank you.
All right. So credit for reduced activity. This one had more language that we needed to clarify, and some that we would like to discuss with you today just to get your expertise on it. So the credit requires that fleets be credited with a reduction in their average and their activity, which is defined as their average annual hours. And it does list two dates. But before we get to that, the one change that we'd like to make in our proposal is to include the horsepower. And the reasons for that are pretty simple. If a large mining fleet stops using a 2,000-horsepower mining truck and they start using a 35-horsepower mower, I think they deserve credit for that. So we do want to include horsepower when we look at the average annual hours. So the way we'd look at it is how much has your activity decreased, and the vehicles with the highest horsepower would, of course, be weighted more. So it's pretty simple. And as far as the dates for determining the reduction in activity, so we have discussed this at both workshops and at other meetings. We read average annual hours for, it says between July 1st, 2007 and March 1, 2010. If you take an average of July 1st, 2007, our interpretation of that is that it's January to December of 2007. And additionally, for the second date, we believe it would be better if we could take 6 months on either side, but obviously you're running up right into the fleet's first compliance date. So you can't project into the future what their activity is going to be and then award them credit. So for this proposal, we're looking at the reduction in activity from the year January to December 2007 to the year March 2009 to February 2010. And we'll talk a little bit about the different records, but those are the two periods where we'd compare activity.
I have a question on the reduction in annual horsepower,
sure,
or hours, and then you said you're going to compute the horsepower as a portion of that. So you're going to have a number for horsepower hours then? You're going to multiply the horsepower times the number of hours?
Correct.
Okay, so that's a good idea for working that. Why couldn't that same idea be applied towards low use? You're talking 100 hours. If I have a piece of equipment that's got 500 horsepower, you allow me 100 hours. But I got a piece of equipment that's got 75 horsepower, you only allow me 100 hours, even though it's less than 20% of the emissions, all things remaining equal, of course.
So I believe, I mean, it could have been done that way, but I believe the purpose of the low-use provision was not to, it was not to try and calculate how much each vehicle was emitting and then limit its use based on that. It was to allow people to have vehicles which were very rarely used to still use those vehicles without just having to scrap them as part of the regulation. So I don't think we'd want a low horsepower machine to keep working for hundreds or thousands of hours just because it was lower horsepower.
The problem that industry has here is that we don't really necessarily get to pick which pieces of equipment that we get to use in a given year. That just depends on what the market brings to us in work. And so if you have a fairly large size fleet for the size of your company, not all the horses are being used every day. You're telling me that, well, I can only use this piece for 2.5 weeks this year, then I can't use this piece anymore, even though I got the other horses parked in the stable.
So you do have the option when you declare something low use not to have it permanently limited to 100 hours. There is a second option, which is called year-by-year low use. So if you use that, you can have it low use in 1 year. It'll come out of your total horsepower. And then if your business model changes and you start using that thousands of hours per year, you can do that. So the one caveat is that you won't get NOx credit when you declare it low use the first time because you're not promising to permanently keep it that way. But I think that would apply to what you're saying. If you have a vehicle you're not using a lot but you may use in the future, I definitely recommend a year-by-year low use. So you can get credit for keeping it under 100 hours in 1 year, but in the future you don't have that limit on it.
The difficulty is trying to anticipate which horse is going to get pulled out of the stable for how many hours ahead of time. If we can apply it retroactively, then I could say, well, I use it this much or I didn't use it this much. But if you're saying I've got to pick a year ahead of me, I have no idea how much hours other than, well, it's been used about this many hours. We'll guess it's low use. I mean, you're putting restrictions on industry that we don't have any way of determining how we're going to measure up because we don't know what the market is going to bring us for work. And right now, most of my stuff is low use. But that's not by design. That's just because of where the market is. I don't know what's going to happen. And, you know, the stimulus money comes out, and all of a sudden we're all busy again.
So we do have a provision where you can use a three-year rolling average. So if in 1 year it does increase over 100 hours, there is some flexibility there. But, yes, it does require some planning ahead of what you're going to use.
Planning ahead, sir, is not possible. See, I'm just telling you. I've been at this game a week or two. You just don't get to plan ahead because it's the market determines what we get to use.
But you can always plan backwards.
We can, in retrospect, we can tell you what we did.
So in those cases, I would just recommend, the only recommendation I have for you is that you might not want to declare those vehicles low use if you don't think that you can be pretty sure that you are going to keep them under 100 hours per year. Go ahead, Bill.
On the question about when you start counting in terms of reduced activity, would it be at all helpful if we brought the bill's author, Brian Nastandi, in to talk to you guys about the intent of the legislature on what time frame that they had in mind? Because our understanding was that they were looking at July of 2006 to July of 2007 as establishing the baseline for activity.
Well, so,
do you want me to comment, or it's up to you?
Yeah, go ahead if you want.
Probably going to say the same thing. We have understood from other parties that the original draft of the bill said to count back from the year, but that's not what was released when they finalized it. So,
if we need to, we will go back and ask for additional legislative guidance, but I don't think we should have to need to do that.
Well, to answer your question, I don't think that we're currently considering changing what we consider an average of the July activity.
Okay, then we do have to. Okay.
Well just another perspective, perhaps. If we're looking at fuel data and other things, for some people it's easier to do it on a calendar basis. They don't have resolution necessarily on a monthly basis.
And some people operate
on districts. Yeah, so another consideration there might be that if we're looking at using data that are not based on hour meters, that data, if it's based on a calendar year, might be more readily accessible to them than breaking it up by a month to month, which may not be, may not have that resolution.
So to address that concern, it sounds like what you're saying is that, well, the first period would match up to a calendar date, but if the second one was instead, or if we allowed in addition to March 1st, 2009 to February 2010, we allowed January 2009 to December 2009 to be used as a second period, or?
No. Going forward, we can get the data. I mean, if we know these are the data we have to maintain for this purpose, we're well aware of that. It's where we're trying to find resolution from historic data is what I'm talking about, Corey. So going forward, you can cut it any way you want. We know mm-hmm. we're on notice. We have to get this information. We'll get it. But it's where we have to try to find data when we weren't aware that these data would be needed. And as I said, calendar data are sometimes more accessible to people than monthly data, just the way they retain records. And they don't have resolution on a monthly. So if you were to split that, say, split a half a year, we're going to be kind of guessing, well, we take the two and average it or something. You know, we don't have monthly resolution necessarily. That's just an observation, Corey.
Thank you.
Some people do.
I'm just offering a separate observation.
Thanks, Corey. This is Eric White. But I just want to address kind of your comment about additional clarification. Yeah. Certainly we've received the letters from the legislators, some of the legislators. I would note that many legislators who voted,
50
who did vote, though, on the final budget were not signatories to that letter. But we've looked at that.
If it's required, we can get them.
No, I'm not sitting here debating you on that. What I'm saying is we've received the letter they've submitted to us. We've taken that carefully under consideration. We've made some changes, I think, as you've seen.
Yes, and we appreciate that a great deal.
But on this one, as we look at the bill language, and we look at, I can appreciate that maybe early drafts had some additional language in there, but again, when you look at legislation that we are enacting, that we're implementing, I should say, we need to go off what was the language of the bills. It's gone, went through a number of negotiations as it was being developed. There was a lot of input on both sides of the aisle into what the final budget language was as it relates to this rule. So all we can go off of is what is in there now. And we think we've done a pretty fair job of looking at that, taking what, you can't just take a single day, two single days on the calendar and say it's what's here and what's there. You need some time before and after. We've had a lot of discussions about that internally. So right now, I think the safest thing I can say is our proposals, we're going to be moving forward with what we have now, I think, as Corey's laid out. And that's right now looking like that's what's going to be our staff proposal for the July hearing.
Well, take a page from your book, Eric. Sometimes we have to agree to disagree. And this might be one of those times.
Sure. So another provision that we're looking at is how to show reduced activity. Now, obviously, if you have an hour meter on each vehicle, it's very easy, and you have logs back to 2007, it's very easy. You can just report your hours over that year. But we also are looking at other ways that fleets could do this. There was obviously no requirement in 2007 to keep track of your activity, so we don't want to penalize fleets who are possibly struggling to meet bankroll just because they didn't have records back in 2007. We don't believe that falls in line with the intent of the legislature either. So we are looking at other ways that a fleet could show us how they've reduced activity. So aside from hour meters, which are a pretty accurate record, if you have hour meters and logs, then you know that's kind of set. You can easily determine your reduction in activity. We are looking at other things like payroll and operator records, if those are tied to certain vehicles, maintenance logs of the equipment, if it gets serviced every 500 hours, that could also be a way possibly to show reduction in activity. And then there are other ways which aren't very specific to the vehicles. They're sort of the overall fleet. Has the fleet's fuel use declined? You run into trouble there because fleets use their fuel, obviously, not just for their off-road vehicles, but sometimes for their generators and other things like that. And then you have even wider, less specific records, like things like overall financial data. Have their revenues declined? Now, that may not have anything to do with their vehicle use because maybe their profitability has gone down, their activity hasn't changed at all. So we're looking at all of these, and as the slide says, not all of these accurately reflect how much your activity has changed. So our proposal is full credit for a fleet which has good records. They can show us what each vehicle has done over the period. And then just so that people who don't have great records don't get any credit, we're looking at some sort of cap. If you have some indication that you've reduced your activity, we want to take that into account and not just say, well, you either have these records or you're out. So we do want to give credit for these other fleets who, and I know a lot of fleets have great records, and if you have that, then you're pretty much done. But for the other fleets, and it may just be a small portion of the California off-road fleet, it may just be 10%, but for the other fleets, we wanted to allow them to get some credit if they can show us somehow that they've reduced activity. So our question really to solve is, what shows, you know, adequately how much the vehicle's activity has gone down? Hour meters? Okay, great. That shows it perfectly. If you have things like payroll, though, can that adequately show how much vehicle use has changed over time, or maintenance logs? And then I don't think that we have too much discussion about whether overall fleet use or fuel use would show vehicles, because we don't think it does, or financial records, but they might show some measure of reduction activity. So we definitely want to solicit your input on that. How do we determine what records can show a fleet has reduced their activity? Does anybody have any initial thoughts?
Well, I would like to first clarify on the hour meter. I don't think that is as simple as you think it is, and I will address the yard truck sites, which is what I'm representing. Yard trucks get bounced around, beat around. They're in the dash. They're in different places. The wires can get disconnected. I've had trucks 6 months old, and we didn't know it was disconnected for almost a year. These are yard trucks, and I'm sure there's similar construction trucks that got the same problem. So when people ask me how many hours are on the vehicle for a purpose of purchasing it, I tell them and disclaim it, this is what it shows, but I'm not going to guarantee that's valid. Now, granted, today with new electronic engines, we're able to go into the engine and determine how many hours is on the engine, but not on an hour meter, and we can't even find them even close.
Okay. Well, that's not on your list of possible things, but it is true that newer machines do have electronic capacity. Is that something you might consider?
If they have computer an electronic readings? Capacity to what record the hours or
record the operation time of the
I think
the
we
equipment?
Definitely would accept either that or also not on the list, but GPS. Which can record whether the engine's running or not in some cases, but very few fleets
yeah,
have that
always,
one. But,
yeah.
but yeah, I think anything where we have a log of the hours is something we consider a very accurate and detailed record if they go back to the periods we're looking at.
I think you also and you have it up there is the overall financial records, but I mean for the most part, fleets are going to have records of how they're recovering the cost of their asset. And for the most part, with equipment, it's an hourly basis. And because you want to recover the costs that you're putting into your equipment, I mean, I only see one fleet, but it's safe to say those are, for Granite's fleet, very accurate records, just based on our internal accounting. So I think there needs to be, I think the financial records need to be given, accurate, right. I think yeah. they need to be given as much cloud as like an hour meter reading. I know that's what we use our revenue hours to track maintenance and everything like that, and then all we do is just reconcile it with hour meter readings.
So it does, but it does end up as a specific log for how much each vehicle has been used mm-hmm. by hours. Okay.
Yeah, and in one of our fleets at SCCA at the South Coast hearing did talk about that, mm-hmm. the fact that they record every single minute that their equipment's operating because of financial requirements that they have as well. I kind of get the notion about the overall financial records because everybody's numbers are down because they're so competitive. If they've got any work at all, they're down. But the fuel use thing, what is the prejudice against fuel use? That would seem to me to be a one-to-one relationship to emissions.
That's, initially one of the things we were looking at is just the overall fuel use, and it seemed like a good surrogate for their vehicle activity. But several fleets, even at the workshop, suggested we don't use that because they use the same fuel receipts for the red dye diesel they put in their off-road vehicles and their generators. And possibly other things which aren't subject to the off-road regulation if they have an agricultural fleet or things like that. So initially we agreed with you. I think that based on the feedback we got, we realized it may not reflect the off-road fleet's actual activity, though.
Does that square up with you guys?
Well, I remember one fellow saying that they use clear in their off-road.
Yeah.
So that would offset, red dye diesel figures. Mm-hmm. We keep similar records to Granite, how they calculate their maintenance and from what Nick's saying. So we're pretty well set that way, but yeah, I seem to get the feeling in South Coast that a lot of fleets don't have records dating back until they figured the regulation was going to make them require to have all that paperwork. So there might be some difficulty there.
I think for a lot of the fleets on ORIAC, it's almost a bad audience because most of you are very involved and you have a very, very good records. What we're looking at is a lot of the fleets who probably don't come to a lot of meetings or aren't very even aware of the environmental regulations. We don't want to just cut them out. So, I don't know if you. I think we heard some additional good records that we could add to a list of what we considered a very specific and detailed record of fleet activity. Do you have any thoughts on payroll or operator records?
If you're only going to allow up to 15% credit on these other methods, is that what you're saying?
That's one of the things we're looking at right now.
Well, you can kind of work with the preponderance of the evidence. If they have seriously reduced payroll operator records, of paying the operators, mm-hmm. and they have a serious reduction in the fuel, and the preponderance of the fuel is going to the off-highway equipment by the basis of the equipment count or anything else, or red dye versus not, I think only allowing 15% is really kind of a slap in the face for a rule that's being developed after the fact. When maybe they didn't have the records. I think you're going to find there's going to be a lot of companies that really don't have hourly records. They just don't run their operation that way.
So it sounds like from your thoughts on that possibly we could allow several different records if they didn't have hour logs or...
Well, if the fuel records confirm with the operator payrolls, it's pretty evident that they're not paying the operators, they're not running the equipment, they're not using the fuel. I mean, mm-hmm.
yeah. Yeah, I agree with Skip. If your payroll for your operators is down and your fuel bill is down,
you're down.
The amount of fuel, you're doing less.
I think we have a little hesitation on that just because it may not – if we don't have which vehicles the operators are using, you know, then we it's hard to tie it to a direct record of how much has that vehicle's activity been reduced. Are they using possibly lower horsepower vehicles? And, for instance, we could cut out a fleet that had reduced their emissions, reduced their activity by horsepower hours, but they just got on to doing other services with lower horsepower vehicles.
Well, that's expounding. That's atmospheric pollution if they're using lower horsepower vehicles.
Right, but I'm saying in that case we wouldn't be giving them credit because if their operator hours stayed the same. But if it was tied to the vehicle, I think it'd be easier for us to say, well, that's an accurate record of the vehicle's activity. I don't know.
Union contractors in the room, you don't tie the operator to the vehicle, do you?
Yes.
You do? You don't?
No, not every time.
Not every time.
I mean, the revenue hours come in on the operator time card.
Yeah, but not by vehicle, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's the equipment number is on the operator time card.
All right. Well, then that seems to be adequate. We do get records of all of our members' hours, and we know that information is readily available. And as long as the preponderance of people are doing that, but you don't, right?
A job has pieces of equipment, it has operators, and it doesn't tie.
But you don't tie the operator to the equipment.
But you have a record of what did the operator run that day. He may not be on the same piece of equipment every day, but you've got a record of what piece of equipment is being used.
Yeah.
You may not have the exact number of hours, but if he's got 8 hours on his time card, you can just make the assumption the equipment is used 8 hours. Yeah. That's what the operator ran that day. But
you're going to have to make it a little simpler for you know, larger companies require a lot more paperwork.
Mm-hmm.
And I've worked with companies that you had to bring them right along to get more paperwork so you could get maintenance records and be able to track things. And smaller fleets are probably not going to have a lot of that. They know what their costs are and work through them. I think Skip's got good points. I don't think they should be penalized if they can't produce the same records as Granite or our company
So how would you – so taking that a step further, let's go to fleets that don't have – any operator hours or hour logs or any kind of record of the equipment itself, just looking at the fleet's overall finances or the fleet's – yeah, let's just look at finances right now. If the fleet can show that their revenue has gone down, obviously that doesn't directly tie into activity because it could be profitability or other things. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on allowing them credit?
Well, it's preponderance of the evidence. You know, my volume went down about 45% in 1 year from 07 to 08.
Mm-hmm.
So it, was my equipment being used less? Oh, absolutely. Did I have less hours for the operators? Absolutely. You know, everything is relative. So if you've got the preponderance of the evidence that's all showing the same thing, that you've got reduced hours, so only allow 15% credit, I think it's a slam.
It should show that you've reduced your overall
activity
by 40%, 80%. By those records.
Right. So I think that what you're saying about a duplication of records which show a certain reduction in activity is something we can work with. But going past the operator hours, which you're saying, I know there are fleets out there who, and I think probably all of you have at least something like operator hours in here, but for those fleets which don't, we don't automatically want to cut them out of any type of credit. And specifically the small fleets who may even be owner-operators,
yeah, and there's a lot of those.
Who won't have anything even as specific as operator hours. So the revenue's gone down.
But they'll have fuel usage and they'll have revenue.
I know it was something that there was some resistance to. I think the fuel usage, I mean, that's going to track. In the absence of other records, I mean, there's going to be fuel receipts and things like that. I mean, there'll be some record of...
Even if they don't possess the receipts for whatever reason, their suppliers could supply it. So...
I checked with my fuel supplier after the last meeting. I said, can you give me the records from 2007? I had it in a half an hour. Every gallon of fuel, of red fuel I bought.
I think also, Corey, I think what you're hearing is that I would be cautious as to capping it at 15%, but I'd also want to have the language say included but not limited to. For example, in the airlines, it's the number of people who sit in an airplane or the amount of pounds of cargo or the time a jet takes off and lands. Mm-hmm. So there's other indicators for other industries.
Right.
The same can be said of the ski industry. So I would want to have, at least in an effort to address the various types of off-road equipment users, you'd have it included but not limited to, and then leave it to the operator to provide to you the basis for the estimates and work with you to show why it's. And if it's in excess of 15%, you all look at, I think, the preponderance of the evidence is a good phrase. Everybody looks at it and go and say, well, that sounds reasonable, that you wouldn't feel constrained at 15%.
I think that's a good suggestion. So one of the things as we develop our staff report on this, we may develop in particular, obviously, all of these provisions, but this one in general, I think we'd be interested in, once we come up with more specific language, getting feedback on it to see if the ORIAC thinks it takes into account all the cases where we would see reduced activity and credit should be granted. So we may send that around on an email. I don't know yet, but we will be developing specific language. Another thing we're focusing on is trying to get the language so that each case doesn't take a staff investigation, because if there are about 8,000 fleets, presumably in this economy, most of them will apply for some reduced activity credit. Probably you're looking at a lot less because you're looking at large fleets primarily, because reduced activity credit, as set up by the legislature, will expire in 2011. But we still don't want 1,300 individual records set in that we need to run calculations for and do an investigation of. So we will be developing the language, but thank you for all your comments today. So for combination of credits, this was one of the things that came up at the workshop and other meetings. Originally, we'd had it set up so that a fleet could choose either their reduced activity credit or they could choose credit for their retirement. Right now, what we're looking at is setting it up so that a fleet could look at the vehicles which had been retired and then look at the rest of their fleet they still had as of March 1st, 2010, and see what the activity reduction in that portion had been, and then get credit for it. I think it's pretty straightforward. If anybody has comments on that, we'd appreciate it, but it seems pretty direct, a pretty simple way to count reduced activity. Any thoughts on that at this time?
Corey, I just wanted to congratulate you on your how you've evolved with your graphing skills.
Yeah, at the initial workshop, I think quite a few people were confused. So, simplify. So, this is our proposal for a combination for a fleet that's experienced some reduced activity, and also has retirements. So, if anybody has thoughts on that in the future, let us know. It seems pretty straightforward to us. So, hopefully. It won't cut fleets out of getting credit.
Well, one other thing to think about, too, is it's not so straightforward. If we try to broaden the records that we accept for reduced activity to things like fuel use that are for on a fleet-wide basis, then this issue gets a lot messier. Because this lovely chart assumes that you can get data on the individual vehicles. So you'll know that these were retired, and then you had an activity reduction for the remainder. If all you have is fleet-wide fuel use, you won't know what happened to just the vehicles that remain.
Well, can you limit it to red dye or something that indicates it's off-road?
You'd have to look at the specific vehicle activity to do this combination, because your decline in red dye use could be part of the retired vehicles. So you'd need some kind of records for the actual vehicles.
And there's a number of fleets that use that are prohibited from using red dye.
Mm. Yeah, if there's a DOT regulates red dye use, if there's any violations with the on-road vehicles, then they're permitted from using red dice. How would you measure that?
Well, so this is an off-road rule. This is not an on-road rule.
No, I understand. No,
but the red dye is prohibited from being purchased.
Right.
For what, like water trucks?
By way of a penalty through DOT.
Or by the regulations that apply to the off-road equipment and stuff. So, I mean, the GSE-operated airports cannot use red dye.
That's just because they want you guys to pay taxes.
If you start getting into a broader measure of reduced activity, like the fuel usage or something like that, mm-hmm. could you almost use, for combining credit purposes, only use the reduction beyond retirement? And does that make sense? So if you
If your fuel usage is down 30% and you've retired 20%, then you get 20% credit for your reduced fleet size and then another 10% because that's the excess.
Yes, but you get 10% anyway because you get 30%. In that case, you get 30%, which is what you could get anyway just with reduced activity. Mm-hmm. I guess in that specific case, it might benefit you because you'd have rollover credits. So I think we could rollover credits for retirements that you wouldn't get if you got reduced activity credits. Mm-hmm. So we could potentially look at that. But even without this interaction, they'd already get 30% credit. So,
Help me if I'm wrong with this, but I thought you guys were very hawkish about the question of double dipping on these, that you were going to establish the requirement for retired equipment, and then any reduced activity below that level was going to be the part that you measured. Am I wrong about that?
Our proposal has evolved over time, and you're right that the reason that we've been, I like that word, hawkish, is we've been worried about accidentally double counting reductions. So we did initially propose that you'd have to look at your activity reduction and your retirement and pick one. And we heard loud and clear from fleets that, hey, that's not fair because I retired some, and then I also, for the stuff I kept, my activities dramatically down. And so we've revised our proposal to try to give fair credit for that. But it's just going to be tricky with the records not being complete.
So this would be a case where it would be very important.
It won't be tricky for some fleets who have accurate and complete records, all right? So those people shouldn't be punished.
Yeah, we agree. And just to be clear, this is different than what we said on April 29th.
Yes, it is. That's why I was asking. Yeah.
So for the fleets that do have those records, as Kim said, if you have a vehicle-by-vehicle record, again, this is simple, but if you have an overall indicator of your fleet activity, it's hard to separate that out from the vehicles which you've retired. So this is a case where it becomes even more important to determine what we will credit fleets as having an accurate vehicle-by-vehicle indicator of activity reduction, as opposed to some overall fleet record where they would be capped, and then, in addition to that, probably could not interact with the reduced activity credit, the retirement credit.
Now, has the treatment of the credits, and you hit on this earlier, but where the reduced activity credit expires, but the retirement credit doesn't expire, is that the same as during the workshops?
So I don't think we've done any changes to those. In general, you know, obviously if you had both, let's say you get both of these credits, we are proposing to apply the reduced activity credit first, so that we're not using up the credits which don't expire. Does that make sense? So I don't think that that's changed at all from the workshop, but it's a detail we may not have covered. Do we have any other questions on the interaction of credits? So this one will really depend on what we credit a fleet for as records which show very accurate vehicle-by-vehicle reduced activity.
Corey, does on the retired 2,000 horsepower, I retired them, you start in 06, say I retired them in 09, mm-hmm. but I had reduced hours on that 2,000 horsepower. Does that impact that 50% reduced activity rate? Or once that I've retired them, I'm only dealing with what's remaining in my fleet at 2010?
Exactly. So if you reduced activity in them and then retired them, you just get full credit for their horsepower as a retirement, but you wouldn't also get credit for the reduced activity.
And then, thank you. And then to Nick's comment, I'm still trying to capture what Nick just put in there in terms of how would you then differentiate between your retired horsepower that doesn't have a sunset and your reduced activity that doesn't have a sunset?
Well, Well, our approach is just that it's kind of simple, but the math gets complicated. The general approach would be that we keep them in separate banks. You'd start using up your reduced activity credit. Okay. It expires. Yeah. Then if you had any left, it would go away. And then you'd start using your other credit.
And
so that would be our proposal.
And I shouldn't say it with him behind me. Would that be
Jeff's worst nightmare?
A function indoors, that would be a separate line item indoors, I guess?
Yes, it would. So it will get... And one of my next slide on here is actually, one of the slides on here is actually Now that we have all these credits and we have the potential for interaction, planning for the regulation does get more complicated. So how can we best show? In the past, we've had a fleet average calculator, and eventually, of course, this will be built into DOORS. Whatever the regulation is amended to will all be part of DOORS. But in the interim, we are looking at a few different options. We have an example packet out there, but we're also looking at a fleet average calculator. We kind of wanted to gauge interest of the group and how valuable that would be. Because obviously, you guys who know the regulation extremely well, it's still somewhat complicated for other fleets. We still want to put all this and give it to them in a way where they can calculate out their credits very easily. So any thoughts on that, we'd appreciate. Does anybody still use the fleet average calculator offhand? Okay. Mm-hmm. Right.
I'm sorry, the question was, do people use both? The answer is yes. It depends on how much time you have to do a quick calc.
Okay. In addition to that, we have two parts that will be part of the staff proposal and the board hearing that weren't in the legislative directive changes, and that is double credit for NOx retrofits, which we discussed here previously. I don't think we've had any opposition to this idea. I don't know for sure that it'll be in there, but I think that's the direction we're heading with, and it's we're pretty happy with that one. And then we're also still looking at lifetime turnover exemptions for retrofit vehicles. I don't know where we're landing on that one, but I think that we haven't received any opposition to it, and internally we like the idea. So we also wanted to look at, and we did cover this in the DEC subcommittee meeting, but we also wanted to look at, is there anything else that would allow fleets to receive, to incentivize fleets to do retrofits or take any other early actions? Go ahead, Dave.
Well, I'd like to go on record again, Kim, on the triple credit for retrofits by 1230-109.
The only people that are opposed to the double credit are the people who want triple credit.
Double credits for retrofits for 1231-2010. And 1.5 credit for retrofits before 12/31/2011, which was on the April 7th proposal.
Right.
I just think it would work. That's all.
Thank you. So just to address that again, we talked about it earlier. We weren't sure if that would incentivize new retrofits or if it would actually just give more credits to the fleets who are already retrofitting. So I'm not sure. We did discuss that further, and maybe we can discuss that idea more internally because we initially hadn't received a lot of excitement about the idea, but I think both Charlie and Dave's suggestions on that we will take into consideration. So if anybody else has ideas on ways or provisions which would incentivize retrofits, you can either bring them up now. Go ahead.
So, Corey, since we're bringing up things that we brought up on the 29th, the idea of using the Moyer money or making fleets eligible that are using credits to have access to the Moyer money. There was a little bit of discussion there. Bob Cross said, hey, I want to think about this a little more. At least I think that's what I heard him say. Mm-hmm. Has that discussion occurred or is that still pending?
I don't think we've gone further with that idea. So to clarify what was proposed then, you were thinking Moyer money for fleets which were in compliance with the regulation by using these new credits.
They would be in compliance, and if you took, and in my mind, this is sort of how I've thought through it, if you took the money, you can't get the extra credit, right? So you can't get double credit if you also get the money.
Okay.
Right? I mean, it seems like you shouldn't get both. Mm-hmm. At least that's how I thought it through. But, yeah, if you were in compliance, then you effectively have pushed your compliance date
you're
out.
You're exceeding your compliance.
You're exceeding your compliance, and you ought to be eligible.
Right.
That's the thinking anyway. So
yeah, no, we haven't pushed that discussion.
All right, fair enough.
So as we talked about, there's a number of different ways to get credit, and as I almost gave Dave a heart attack at one of the workshops, you still get your credit from previous repowers and retrofits. So that hasn't changed, and it's on top of these other credits. So we didn't talk about them because they're not really changing. But if you have thoughts on how we can put these out, we'd definitely be glad to hear it. I don't know if we would do training seminars. One of the ideas we're floating is training seminars for people who are already familiar with the regulation, just for compliance planning and how to manage their credits. So that would be one way to get information out there. But it doesn't help fleets identify what their options are personally. So I don't know. There's a few different things we're thinking about. If you have ideas, we'd like to hear it. So with that, we're going to go into a five-minute overview of each of the subcommittees that we went through today. Most of the people here are the same, but we do have people joining us through webcast. So I'm going to invite, well, first, do we have any questions? No? Okay. So I'm going to invite Dave Porcher up here to give us an overview of the fleet subcommittee meeting. Or actually, you can do it right there. That's fine.
Yeah, if you don't mind. I got all my notes here. In the fleet subcommittee, we discussed four topics, and I'll give a brief rundown of those topics and who brought them to the table. First topic number one was from Camarillo Engineering, and that's Tier Zero's designated or bought for non-operational purposes. Retiring of equipment utilized for parts salvage, the purchase of equipment with Tier Zero engines to be utilized for parts salvage, purchase of equipment with Tier Zero engines for the purpose of parts distribution or resale. And we'd like to see a drop-down box and doors for retire for parts. We discussed this in the meeting, and Corey said that we'd have 30 days to let me back up here. Corey, on that 30 days, let me ask you.
Sure.
That was for reporting, right?
So the basic idea would be that if somebody wanted to buy a Tier Zero or another machine, that they were restricted from adding to their fleet under the regulation. They could buy it, make it non-operational within 30 days, and then just simply not report it to us because it's a non-operational machine. The 30-day window is because they have 30 days to report any vehicles. So they would have 30 days to basically make it non-operational. And how we would define that is something we're moving forward on. There's a number of obvious ways, such as removing the engine, but there may be other ways for if you couldn't take out the engine in time.
Corey, just a quick thought on
that.
Thank you. The cargo handling equipment regulation will allow you to remove the batteries and fluids and call it non-operational. Yeah. You could use a similar program.
We also discussed fuel.
Mm-hmm. Fuel pumps.
Yeah. Well, we only have 5 minutes for the review, so. Topic two was from Nabors Well Drilling Service on providing a level playing field for fleets competing for jobs. Tier Zero fleets have the same requirements, 8% turnover and 20% retrofit. With a retrofit waiver, the Tier Zero fleet could have an unfair advantage. And, of course, we only have 5 minutes for this. We did discuss it in some detail. Staff has said they don't plan on putting any more of a penalty on the Tier Zero fleet, but would discuss possible extra credit for proactive fleets, correct?
We'd definitely be open to ideas.
Okay. And on topic three was from Echo Equipment Rentals on VDEC safety exemption. We discussed problems that rental company has had over a 9-month period of seeking waiver for retrofit, and this went into quite a bit of detail, and ORIAG and staff will be working together to try and work on a solution for this problem, correct?
We will be looking at all safety issues related to VDECs.
Okay. And then our topic four was from AEM and discussed the success of reporting efforts and a stronger promotion of registration to prevent floods of requests coming in all at once? And I'll let Corey respond to that one.
So this is part of the outreach discussion. And additionally, there was the topic raised of when a fleet owner has to report, a lot of times they have to contact all the manufacturers for their vehicles and get more information. So we did promote heavily reporting for large, for all fleet sizes, since Doors went live September last year. And as you can see on the graph we had earlier, we went 6 months and we had 25%, and then in the month and a half after that, we quadrupled that up to our current total. So if you have thoughts about how we can push fleets to report early so we avoid those situations, then we'd love to hear those. I think we're doing everything we can think of on our end. So any outreach ideas you have or any ideas you have to promote reporting for the medium and small fleets, and obviously the large fleets who are late, we would like to hear those.
And for all those on the webcast, these issues will be talked about again, and we'll solicit input. And any concerns fleets have that they feel that they would like addressed in ORIAG, if they contact Corey or Elizabeth White, Kim Heroy Rogalski, or myself, Dave Porcher, Camarillo Engineering, we'll be happy to address them. And that's all I have.
So we are going to go into the overview of the DOORS subcommittee meeting. In DOORS, we talked about some of the new tools, which aren't live yet, but we have planned principally a tool for the public to look up information on a vehicle when they have its ARB issued EIN. And I think our decision on that was that we didn't feel that there was a great benefit to anyone and that it did have possible privacy issues for anyone in the public to be able to see who owned a vehicle. So we do plan at this time to take off that functionality and just have maybe some information on the vehicle pop up, such as model and make or vehicle type, so that people can make sure that that EIN does belong on the vehicle, but no information on the owner or things like that. Another thing we talked about at the DOORS subcommittee was stolen vehicle reporting is something we're going to be implementing in the future. And on top of that, there will be a public page to see all the fleets who have reported to us. And additionally, if you have any fleets that you think should be on that list but aren't, you can talk with them and you can talk with us to make sure that they are where they should be. So with that, I think we're going to go to Charlie Cox with the DEX subcommittee update.
Okay. Thanks, Corey. No whining. Okay, no whining. So in the
5 minutes, Charlie, 5 minutes.
Thank you, Tom. Get to be the last guy of the day. You bet it'll be quick. So the first thing we went over was a rather lengthy conversation on the current back determination methodology and process in DOORS right now, and just had a discussion about how the current procedure is based primarily around engine family code and requires some refinement because there are many other criteria to consider. So it's not just about engine family code. It's horsepower. It's traction type. It's there are a number of considerations to factor in, and not the least of which is whether or not that particular device is applicable to that particular machine or machine type. So more work is needed on the part of staff, but with probably considerable additional input from the manufacturers and maybe more installers, regarding what can be applied to technologies, and just being careful within DOORS to clarify that when you see something that it comes up on the back determination, it's more of a it's not even a recommendation. It's a it's simply a review of the engine family code, and the fleet owner should go and review that information with the device manufacturers, with their equipment manufacturers, and have that conversation so that they can clarify whether or not something is applicable, not just verified. So there's a great deal more work to do on that. We did discuss some of the regulatory amendments, the legislative directed changes, and you know, some of the impacts that we believe some of those changes will have on retrofit installations and purchases. So, you know, we went over quite a bit of that information, and you know, just talked about some of the pros and cons of the proposals we just saw in the presentation that Corey gave. So, we had on the agenda as well an update an opportunity to discuss with the retrofit assessment section the verification issues related to track, steel wheel, and rubber tire applications. We weren't able to complete that portion of the conversation, but we're going to submit written comments and look for staff's feedback on that as well. So.
Thank you. Thank you. And the one thing I will add to the DOORS report is that we are looking for as much feedback as possible on the compliance planning tools, both look and functionality. So if you have any thoughts as you go through that, it's going to affect a lot of people. We really appreciate your comments on getting it right. So if you can forward those to me, I'll get them to the appropriate places. So with that, does anybody else have any comments or questions? All right, thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Corey.